really sure why I didn't rebel. When I was younger, I used to get teenage points, which is when my, like, you know, the couple moments that I could act like a teenager and not follow along with what my parents said. I think it's really just the fact that they brought me up to care so much about other people and so much about my environment rather than just my own personal self and my own image. I don't really worry or care about conforming because that's not my biggest priority at all.
Well, it sounds like as an 18-year-old, you've got some pretty strong priorities figured out, and it sounds like you're looking out for the good of all of us. So thank you for that. And I want to thank you for joining us on the KBOO News today. I've been speaking with Kelsey Juliana. She is one of the plaintiffs in a lawsuit against Governor Kitzhaber and the state of Oregon, challenging the state's failure to protect essential natural resources, including the atmosphere, state waters, and coastlines, as required under the public trust doctrine. Thank you for joining us today, Kelsey.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
In 2011, Troy Davis was executed by the state of Georgia despite a compelling case of innocence. This sparked a global movement to end the death penalty. Hear a firsthand account of his story and readings from the book I Am Troy Davis on Prison Pipeline, June 16th at 6:30 p.m.
Is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014 at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100 plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank. More information on artists, tickets, and the KBOO broadcast of the festival can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series, which on Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. will show The Price of Sex. This feature-length documentary sheds light on the underground criminal network of human trafficking and the experiences of trafficked Eastern European women forced into prostitution abroad. The Price of Sex includes first-person accounts, as well as interviews with traffickers, clients, and anti-trafficking activists to expose the root causes, complex connections, and stark significance of sexual slavery today. Again, that's Saturday, July 5th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9 to 5. survivor, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Time is 6:04 p.m. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. This is Labor Radio. I'm your host, Nick Bubb. Unless you've been hiding under a rock, you've probably heard in the news recently that Seattle has passed the $15 minimum wage. And if you're like me, you're very curious. What does this mean? When does it take effect? Well, I have someone from Seattle, from the 15 Now campaign, to talk with us today about this. We have Jess Spear on the line. Jess, are you there?
I am. Hello. Happy to be with you.
Oh, amazing. Thanks for being with us tonight. How are you?
Doing good.
All right. Well, everybody wants to know what's going on with the $15 minimum wage and how did Seattle win this?
I think that's a really excellent question because we would definitely credit the brave fast food workers who went out on strike over a year ago for sparking this movement and really putting that bold demand out there for 15 and a union. But we also have to, you know, note that it was Seattle that was able to pass the $15 an hour minimum wage, even though these strikes happened all over the country. And the situation in Seattle, I think, made it possible because we elected a new city council member, Shama Sawant, who was the first socialist elected to the city council in Seattle in 100 years. And
wow.
We ran a grassroots campaign, you know, really mobilizing the community around a demand for $15. And also just to make the city affordable for everybody with rent control and taxing the super wealthy to pay for social services. But the real bold demand that she had on her platform that really connected with working people was $15 an hour. And this happened at the same time that the fast food strikes came to Seattle. So they helped to build one another. You know, the campaign helped to build support for the strikes, and the strikes themselves helped to build support for the election campaign.
That's awesome.
So,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, you know, we elected the first socialist, and she was elected sort of showing the political establishment that the strikes had legitimacy. There was a lot of support. This person unseated a 16-year incumbent who was considered a shoo-in. And it really helped to put it at the top of the political agenda. Shama is a member of Socialist Alternative, as am myself, and we, you know, helped to launch 15 Now, to really mobilize community support for these fast food strikers and to really start to get out there in the community and build support for 15, answer the common questions. All of the campaigns that the unions had organized up to that point, which were incredibly important, really only involved the workers themselves and organizing them. And what we wanted to do was help build that community support and really build a movement around it to put the pressure on the rest of the political establishment to deliver a $15 an hour minimum wage.
That's an amazing victory. So we've got you, we've got with Socialist Alternative, 15 Now, we've got Shama, we've got the fast food workers, the workers of Seattle, everybody bands together to win the $15 minimum wage. But I'm guessing there was probably some people that were fighting against it.
Yes, there was, absolutely. So, I mean, as you can imagine, businesses were fighting this, and they were doing it sort of in a strategic way. And what I mean by that is they recognized that there was such a groundswell of support for 15 that they could not come out immediately and be against 15. And actually, I should add one other factor that led to Seattle becoming the first major city to winning 15 was SeaTac, the suburb just south of Seattle where the airport's located, passed a $15 an hour minimum wage for airport-related workers. And there was a lot of union support for that. They wanted at the ballot box. And so, you know, they realized that, okay, it passed in SeaTac at the ballot box, and we're not going to be able to come out directly against it because that will just expose us to being, you know, very anti-worker and pro-profits. So what they did was they, you know, got involved with the new mayor and signed up to be involved in his advisory committee. A number of business interests were sitting there and trying to devise ways to say they supported 15, but working to undermine it. And what I mean by that is, you know, trying to get other things included in how you count wages, like health care deductions or counting tip towards wages. different things that they tried to do to carve out some loopholes to make it so they didn't have to pay a full 15. And also trying to work in long phase-in periods where, you know, they could have up to 10 years to pay their workers 15. And they fought very hard to get those loopholes included. And I think, though, the fact that they were unable to come out directly against 15 shows what support existed, not only inside the movement, but just in the community in general. The poll in February showed 68% supported it, and even after a barrage of media articles discussing business interests and how businesses were concerned and all the fear-mongering that they were whipping up, talking about, you know, skyrocketing inflation and, mm-hmm. you know, how a burger is going to go up to $15, that still did not erode that support. The support actually increased to 74% by May 1st.
Wow.
Yeah, so, it, you know, business really could not come out and fight it. But they're fighting it now, even though it's just been passed. With the Franchise Association has now filed a lawsuit against it. They want to be counted as small businesses and not large businesses. And then also there's a local small business restaurant group called Ford Seattle that was trying to put forward $12.50 over 5 years.
Okay, so that didn't get in there, obviously. What kind of loopholes did get put through? Did any of those get put in there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most egregious loopholes was the 3 to 4 year phase-in for very large businesses. You know, businesses like McDonald's or Starbucks or QFC, large groceries, they get 3 to 4 years to adjust to pay their workers 15, even though these businesses are, you know, in McDonald's case, raking in billions in profits, you know, while they're paying their workers poverty wages. So that was... that got carved out, and we did everything we could to fight that. But unfortunately, the other city council members in Seattle voted for it, and it was really only Chamisawant that voted against it and really tried to work against it. There's also a 5 to 7 year phase-in for smaller businesses. And mm-hmm. the businesses, you know, they're defined as 500 employees or less. So these are not your small mom-and-pop shops that you're thinking about. These are rather large businesses. So they get a long phase-in to adjust, which, of course, you know, just is another year keeping their workers in poverty. And that's why our group is called 15 Now, because we recognize mm-hmm. no matter where you work, whatever industry, size of business, you know, the cost of living is going up for you. You don't have a different rent because you work at a small business. Mm-hmm. So we were very unhappy with these long phase-in. The other thing that got slipped in was a tip penalty. Washington State is one of only 7 states that does not have a tip penalty. Tipped workers are paid the same minimum wage as other workers, mm-hmm. giving them the financial stability that's necessary. And the Washington Restaurant Association, which is associated with the National Restaurant Association, or the other NRA, as we call it, they have been working for years to try to get a tip penalty back in Washington State. And I think they've sort of cracked open a door a little bit in Seattle by... getting in a period of a tip penalty. So over a 7-year period, they're going to be allowed to count some wages or some tips as wages, and then it's supposed to phase out. And we have to be very vigilant to make sure it actually sunsets, because as we know, with like the Bush tax cuts, these types of things will continue to be pressured for on the business side of things, and it's important for workers and for, you know, groups that support workers to make sure they keep up the pressure and don't allow that tip penalty to stay in place.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I would say is that the enforcement language is very weak, considering there's 4 different pathways to getting to 15, and that tips are counted, and also health care deductions. This makes it very difficult for workers to know what they're supposed to be paid, and mm-hmm. also some employers probably, but it allows wage theft to take place, and we already have a problem with wage theft all across the country, but also in Seattle. And so the enforcement language is not very strong. The penalties are not very strong, which is quite striking. If you stole from your boss, you know, you would go to jail. But if your boss steals from you, he gets a slap on the wrist and maybe a fine, which really shows, you know, whose interests the government's serving in this case. But yeah, so we have to be very vigilant about those corporate loopholes. And I think for other cities that are fighting to bring 15 there, they should take the lesson that not that these loopholes will always be inserted, but that business will always fight for them. Mm-hmm. And if we want to protect ourselves against them and really fight for 15, a full 15, we have to build a very powerful movement.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I think it's also very short-sighted of the restaurant business. I studied a little bit at the University of Washington. One of the things that has always stayed with me that I learned is that Henry Ford revolutionized the country, not just by making the automobile and the assembly line process, but he paid his workers a revolutionary wage of $5 a day. And this allowed his workers to enjoy a better quality of life, but it also enabled them to buy his product. They all were able to buy a Ford automobile, you know, and I'm wondering how many people that work in restaurants right now are actually able to afford to take their family out to meal. You know, if they're not making $15 an hour, I wouldn't suspect it's very many of them at all.
I really agree with you. I used to be a server in Virginia and Florida where they did have tip penalties. And it's very difficult when you're not making enough money to actually go out at a local restaurant or a local shop and spend any money. And in fact, small businesses and restaurants have really been hit hard by the economic recession and the very weak recovery, because so much of the recovery has gone to the top. Consumers don't have money in their pockets to spend at local businesses. And this is one way of stimulating the local economy. Putting more money in the pockets of consumers allows them to go out to that restaurant that maybe they're only able to go to once a month. Now they can maybe go 2-3 times a month, really helping those restaurants. And you're right, all the economic data shows that what you know intuitively is true, that restaurants actually do quite well when you increase the minimum wage, because people get excited and they want to go out to eat or they want to shop. They finally have some disposable income.
Right, yeah, exactly. So for us down here in Portland who don't benefit from this yet, what kind of advice would you give to us? How can we bring this movement to our town?
Yeah, so we have a 15 Now chapter there in Portland, and they've been organizing a very vibrant campaign for probably 5 months now. I know that they were working to elect independent candidate Nicholas Caleb, and they've organized Living Wage Wednesdays where, you know, they're convening at City Hall to really bring attention to the support that exists for 15. I think, though, that Oregon State does not allow municipalities to set their own minimum wage. And so you have somewhat of a larger hill to climb up. But I think that, you know, the history of human civilization shows that, you know, laws can absolutely be overturned if there's popular support. So what I would say is that the model that we use here in Seattle is absolutely transferable to Portland, in that you build a grassroots campaign. Get the community organized. We had action groups in all the different neighborhoods in Seattle, where people would come together, discuss strategy, and discuss how they could get out there and visibly show the support that exists, whether it's banner drops or, you know, just doing sign waving on corners and things like that, to really let people know that there's a demand out there and people really support it. Once you build grassroots support like that and you can take it to the elected officials, they start to, you know, they're pressured at that point to really deliver something. And I think all across the country, people are moving into action on income inequality and really fighting back against this notion that workers aren't worth it and that we just have to work harder or get educated. And I think that the fact that so many, you know, college graduates are working low-wage jobs and that 60% of the jobs created are in low-wage just totally shows that that's not possible, that we really want better wages, better working conditions. We have to fight for it. So I would encourage Portland to build a very vibrant grassroots campaign and also to start supporting independent left-wing candidates. It was very helpful to have a bold socialist sitting on the city council to help galvanize the movement, give it a voice in City Hall, bring workers in there, bring their perspective into the conversation, so that we had a movement both inside and outside the process.
Yeah, no, we definitely had the candidate down here, Nicholas Caleb. He got 18% of the vote, so unfortunately he didn't make it this time. But that just shows with the grassroots campaign how far you can go. I mean, even in a first attempt, how many people, Barack Obama, if I'm not mistaken, didn't get elected his first time running. Not for president, but for other office.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You have to keep building on that support, and I know that Nicholas is still continuing to build on the support for 15. And he's very genuine in calling for 15 and building support around it. You don't have to have somebody elected to win. I mean, we can look at the radical environmental regulations that were passed in the 1970s under the Nixon administration.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon wasn't pro-environment,
right.
But he had to respond to the will of the people when you had millions of people in the street. So if you galvanize thousands of people in Portland to really put the pressure on the city council, it doesn't matter who's there. They have to bend to that will, or else they're just seen as completely illegitimate.
So you guys have definitely won a major victory up there, and it sounds like there's still some challenges to the process ahead. For people that are interested, how can they help out? How can they get involved?
I would really encourage everybody that supports what we're doing and wants to see this expand to their city, wants to see it expand across the nation, to please donate to 15 Now. We have a sizable debt that we incurred to win 15 in Seattle, and we encourage everybody to please make a donation to 15now.org so they can help us take care of those debts so that we can go on to other cities.
Mm-hmm.
And also to sign up and get involved. And if you don't see a chapter in your city, then you can contact us and we can help you get started so you can get going on building, you know, a movement in your local area. And there is a 15 Now Portland group,
mm-hmm.
and they're 15nowpdx.org, I believe. You can sign up mm-hmm. and get involved with them as well.
Awesome.
Oh, and the last thing I will say is that Socialist Alternative has a new branch in Portland. If you're interested to learn more about socialism and a socialist strategy for winning 15, I would encourage your listeners to get involved with Socialist Alternative in Portland.
Well, that's awesome. I'm actually glad that you mentioned that. I got two guys here in the studio with me. One of them's from 15 Now Portland, and the other one is associated with Socialist Alternative in Portland.
Oh, wonderful.
So I'm going to move on to these guys, and thank you very much for being on the show with us today. There's a lot of people that are excited for the $15 movement, and I'm hoping that it's going to come to Portland soon.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so as promised, in the studio with me are Michael and Justin. And how are you guys tonight?
Doing well.
Great, thanks.
Awesome. And so, Justin, you're with the 15 Now in Portland, is that right?
Yeah, correct.
All right, so what's going on with the movement down here?
Oh, well, quite a bit. You know, as Jess was saying, we really sort of got our start back in March, late February, March, when Nicholas Caleb announced that he was running for city council,
mm-hmm.
and sort of ran a really fast whirlwind campaign. I mean, he announced that he was running kind of right at the deadline. He only had 2 months to run and about $5,000 to do it with, and managed to get about 20% of the vote against the longest sitting incumbent in the city. So we feel that was really impressive, and it did a whole lot. Him running on a $15 an hour platform and making that his primary issue. It did a lot to bring focus to the campaign and to get the word out there to people in the city. And so we really pushed for him to win, because mm-hmm. we saw what had happened in Seattle with Shama Sawant, and thought that was potentially our best bet to really get something done in a hurry. So the 15 Now campaign itself really sort of started off focusing on city council, and how can we pressure city council? You know, that's where Nick Caleb and his campaign are sort of focusing the pressure. So how can we aid that? And so we've done that. We built the Living Wage Wednesdays event, which was once a week up until the election, and it's mm-hmm. once a month now, every second Wednesday of the month. And we just did a presentation in front of city council at the last city council meeting. We've met with Dan Saltzman, and really just trying to put pressure on the council to do what they can. And that's been successful so far. I mean, there are some things they can do. They can challenge the preemption law at the state, which it looks like they've pledged to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a few exceptions to the preemption law that they actually could work towards implementing now.
Mm-hmm.
And in our exchanges with them recently over the last week or so, it seems like they're not really quite so interested in exercising those exemptions for various reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know they're different for the different exceptions, but sort of getting to what Jess said about how what we could really do here to make 15 happen is to build a strong and powerful grassroots movement. I think that's exactly what we need to start doing. We need to shift our focus away from the council and really focus on being in the streets, being on bus lines and max lines, going door to door, going into fast food restaurants and talking to low wage workers. Because
mm-hmm.
that's an aspect of the campaign that's really been lacking so far. We had the whole candidate thing, but there haven't been any fast food walkers or workers walking out on strike in Portland. There have been events surrounding the sort of national strikes and everything that activists mm-hmm. have gotten involved in, but there haven't been anybody walking out from the actual stores yet. And so we really need to build that worker community movement that can push the council farther than they've already gone. You know, we feel that they've come around to an extent. You know, after a decade, they're finally actually talking about minimum wage and talking about the preemption law out of nowhere. But we still have a long way to build in order to actually get them to act on 15.
So for everyone out there that's listening at home, can you tell us what the preemption law is?
Yeah, so it's a law that was put into place in the early 2000s, 2001 or 2002, when the state's minimum wage was indexed to inflation. Mm-hmm. And it's a piece of legislation that Alec wrote and modeled at the very beginning of the year 2000, about a year before it was passed in Oregon. And it was something that the corporate interests got slipped in as an amendment to the indexing of the minimum wage to inflation. Yeah. We're able to slip in, you know, we'll support this as long as you make sure that no cities or municipalities can raise the wage any higher than what the state sets it.
Yeah, that's awful. I mean, yeah. I just got finished up with contract negotiations with my job as well. Mm-hmm. And I know by looking at the inflation numbers that are officially posted, I think things inflate quite a bit faster than the actual official statistic that they put. So if they're pegging increases to the minimum wage to that, that's not enough.
Well, and it's indexed to the national inflation rate, mm-hmm. which unfortunately in Portland has been about half. Our inflation rate has been about double the national inflation rate over the last two or three years at least. So that small raise that people are getting every year is only accounting for a small portion of the increase in prices that they're seeing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So for people out there that are listening right now, everybody's thinking, you know what, I'd like to make $15 also, because what is the minimum wage right now? I'm not even certain. Is it eight something?
Nine ten.
Now that's not enough. $10 is not enough. You can't afford to live. You can't afford to go out. You can't. I mean, you got to have roommates at that point. I mean, what if you have a spouse? What if you have children?
Right.
What are you gonna do with $9.10 an hour? Yeah. You could work 40. You could work 50 or 60 hours a week, and you would still be very impoverished.
Yeah, actually, there have been numbers that have come out very recently surrounding that. The National Low Income Housing Association, National Low Income Housing Coalition, just a couple months ago put out a report stating that essentially for a single parent to be able to afford adequate housing in Southeast Portland, she has to either work 78 hours per week at minimum wage, or she has to make $17.75 an hour.
Wow. So 15 now
is even really not enough. Yeah,
is not enough. And that's amazing. You know, I talk to people about this. I'm very passionate about it. I believe that we need an increase, and I think most people are on board for it. But I get a couple of feedback, you know, comments from people. I get a little bit of feedback, and people will say to me that they don't believe that minimum wage jobs are designed to be a living wage job. They call it entry or starter, or they think it's for high school kids, you know. And I go back and forth with them, and I'm like, well, what other jobs are there right now? I just read an article today. Starbucks announced that they hire 50,000 people for retail positions every year, but they get over 4 million applications. Mm-hmm. It's almost like winning the lottery to get a job that pays very a low wage job that doesn't even pay $15 an hour.
Yeah, and in a city like Portland, where increasingly there's a large population of younger people coming into the city, mm-hmm. who are looking for jobs, those tend to be the jobs that they can get, and those are the jobs that are available for them.
Mm-hmm.
So if those are the only ones that are available and they're all low wage jobs, you have a population of people who, a large section of the population who are resigned to work low wage jobs for a long time.
Right. Well, and I think it's the general trend of our country right now. I mean, two-thirds of the jobs that were lost during the recession were middle-income jobs, and in the last few years of recovery, about the same amount, two-thirds of the jobs that have been gained are low-wage, mm-hmm. minimum-wage jobs. It's McDonald's and it's Starbucks and it's
sure.
Retail service jobs. So I mean, the whole and you know, loss of industrialization in our country goes mm-hmm. back a lot farther than just the last few years. But we're definitely seeing a trend where, you know, in the next 10, 20 years, we're looking at half of the jobs in the U.S. potentially being low-wage jobs.
Sure, yeah. And those are the ones that aren't being replaced by machinery or technology.
Right.
You know, and they outsource so many jobs. But the horrible thing is you got these giant corporations that get tax breaks to set up shop here. They say that I'll bring 500 jobs to your area, sure. And like Walmart, you know, they get they said the average Walmart supercenter gets over $1 million per year in welfare benefits for their employees just to be able to afford basic living and food. And then they get tax breaks for being here, and they take the profits that they earn off of us and they send them overseas and they keep them there so that they don't even have to pay taxes at the federal level.
Right.
Yeah, it's estimated now that I think this past year something like $2 trillion has been held overseas by the top 500 corporations.
Oh yeah.
That should be paid back into the American economy in taxes.
Yeah.
That we just aren't getting. And yeah.
Right. Well, and that's one of the things that we're trying to push here with our city council right now is the idea of a living wage tax, where, you know, let's actually start taxing wealthy people and big, huge corporations so that we can make 15 something that's reasonable for even, you know, small little local mom and pop shops that might have a really small margin,
right.
Maybe really can't afford to pay their employees $15 an hour. Unfortunately, the political will is just not there for it. I think that's been made pretty clear by our city council.
But I think by the numbers, and Nicholas Caleb getting almost 20%, I think with nobody knowing him, and that's unheard of.
Yeah.
And I think that is an indication that people are fed up. I think it's time for 15 now. And I think it's time for more than that. But I think that people are really getting behind this. And we're actually out of time here. The folks from Prison Pipeline are going to want to put their show on. But this is such an important thing, you guys. Thank you so much for coming down to the studio.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
How can real quick, how can people get involved? Everybody wants to help. How can they help?
Well, you know, I mean, like Jess Spear said, you can always go to the 15now.org website and donate. They're trying to set up a national branch right now that can help out all the different locations outside of Seattle. And then we've got our own site, 15nowpdx.org. We've got, you know, volunteer contact forms. There's a donation page there that you can donate directly to 15nowpdx. And then Socialist Alternative.
Yeah, and you can go to socialistalternative.org, sign up to become a member. We just started a new branch here. We've been here.